It is utterly beyond question that in reshaping Enron after he was named its president, Skilling turned it into a place where financial deception became almost inevitable. In no small part, that's because there were so many other kinds of deception taking place. Skilling created a freewheeling culture that he touted as innovative, but didn't rein in the excesses that came with it. He preached the gospel of intellectual capital, claiming that it was critically important to give smart people the resources and freedom to let creativity flourish, but looked the other way when this became a license for wastefulness and self-indulgence. He bragged about Enron's sophisticated controls, but undermined them at every turn. He was openly scornful of steady, asset-based businesses that grew slowly but generated cash, then swept them away to make room for a series of ever bigger, ever riskier bets that brought in almost no cash at all. Worst of all, Skilling created impossible expectations and unbearable internal pressures by holding Enron out to Wall Street as something that it simply wasn't. He created a wild, out-of-control experiment, yet presented it as a well-oiled machine that generated steadily growing profits. He offered the world a powerful, even charismatic vision of the new Enron, but the Enron Skilling was describing, and which by 1998 Wall Street and the press were once again lapping up, wasn't even close to reality. That was an excerpt from The Smartest Guys in the Room by Bethany McLean and Peter Elkind. It's the book we're discussing today. Unless you live under a rock, you've definitely heard of Enron, even if you don't know exactly what happened. Most people equate the word Enron with fraud, more specifically, accounting fraud. At its peak, Enron was the seventh largest publicly traded company in the United States. Its market cap was $70 billion, and they employed over 20,000 people. We're going to go through the whole story, but I want to give you a bit of a roadmap before we do. There are a lot of details with this one, and I think it's helpful to have some context to anchor to while we discuss what happened. Basically, Enron was formed in the mid-1980s by the merger of two natural gas companies. It began primarily as a natural gas company and then transformed to other things, a trading company, a development company, an electric company, and much more. Jeff Skilling came into the company as a McKinsey consultant, and he pioneered a new business model for the company. He also led them through the later half of the 90s when growth companies were the rage. Skilling created a terrible corporate culture. Enron ran rampant with greed, selfishness, excess, bad incentives, poor controls, you name it. He also became a slave to the stock price, and every move he made was in service of making the number next to the ticker symbol go up. Enron presented themselves to the market as a growth company, but their business model was not aligned with this sort of growth, so they had to start doing unethical and then eventually illegal things to keep the market happy. This ultimately led to a highly leveraged business that didn't make any money. And when problems began to become public, the stock price dropped, the credit disappeared, and the company quickly ran out of cash. All right, that's the basic SparkNotes version, so you know what we're dealing with. Now we're going to dive into the weeds and understand the story in full detail. Let's go all the way back to 1985 and look at the company from the beginning. And to do that properly, we need to understand the man behind the company, Ken Lay. Lay came from super humble beginnings in Missouri, but he was a smart guy. He ended up studying economics in college and eventually earned a PhD. I liked this explanation from the book. Although Lay stood out for his brains, he was never the stereotypical egghead who spent every waking moment in the library. Though slight, low-key, and quiet, he struggled for years to overcome a mild stammer, he was popular as well. At Missouri, he won election as president of Beta Theta Pi, the university's largest and most successful fraternity. Among Lay's predecessors in the Missouri frat house was Walmart founder Sam Walton. Lay became an inveterate collector of relationships. At every major stop in his early life, he forged bonds that lasted for decades. These weren't only personal acquaintances. Time and again, he would tap his growing network for a job, for a favor, or to surround himself with those he trusted. This skill propelled his climb. So Lay used these relationships that we just heard about to land jobs at Exxon, the Pentagon, and as Undersecretary of Energy in the Nixon administration. His experience as an energy policymaker during the early 1970s, with electrical brownouts, natural gas shortages, and the Arab oil embargo, gave him a unique perspective on the energy industry. And he quickly left the government for the private sector, where he believed energy shortages provided huge opportunities. So when he left the government in 1973 for the private sector, he went to Florida Natural Gas, where he worked until 1979, by which time he'd become president of the company. His next stop was at Transco, a Houston natural gas company where he joined as president. Then, in the summer of 1984, he left Transco to take the CEO job at Houston Natural Gas. The next year, HNG accepted a buyout offer from Internorth, a big Omaha pipeline company, and by some sleight of hand magic, Lay ended up being the CEO of the merged company. The merger created a natural gas super company, a company that came to be known as Enron. Valued at $12 billion, they had 37,000 miles of gas pipeline, stretching from the Pacific to the Atlantic and from Canada to Mexico. Most importantly, it had access to the three fastest-growing markets, California, Texas, and Florida. By 1986, Lay moved the corporate headquarters to Houston, and he was dealing with a few major problems. One of the problems was an activist investor who owned about 17% of the company. This problem had a $350 million price tag. Another problem was deregulation. The increased supply of gas on the market caused prices to drop, leaving Enron with $1 billion in liabilities. And finally, the government of Peru decided to nationalize Enron's production assets, resulting in another hit of $218 million. Needless to say, the newly formed Enron needed money. But lucky for Enron, there was a small profitable group buried away in the remnants of Internorth. That group, unlike the rest of the company, operated out of Valhalla, New York. It came to be known as Enron Oil, and it was run by a guy named Lou Borget. It was a small group of oil traders that operated more like Wall Street than like Enron. Here's some context from the book. The traders were a kind of secret weapon in the ongoing struggle to improve Enron's financial appearance. For unlike most of the rest of Enron, oil trading actually made money. Internal financial reports often bragged about the profits the traders were producing. "We were the golden-haired boys in the Enron fold," recalls Hogan. In 1985, the year of the Internorth HNG merger, Borget's group made $10 million. The following year, a year when Enron's ongoing business lost money, the oil traders made $28 million for the company. That year, their bonus pool was $9.4 million to be split among just a handful of traders. And there was every expectation that Borget and his crew would keep pumping profits into the company. As Borget himself put it reassuringly in a 1986 report he prepared for the Enron board, "Oil trading, as done by professionals in the industry today, using sophisticated tools available, can generate substantial earnings with virtually no fixed investment and relatively low risk." In other words, it was the perfect modern business. Oil trading looked like fast, easy money, and that's all that mattered. Of course, easy money is rarely as easy as it looks. Such was the case with Enron Oil's trading division. By the time Ken Lay and his minions in Houston realized something was horribly wrong, more accurately, by the time they were willing to face up to what they should have seen all along, the oil traders had come within a whisker of bankrupting the company, and Wall Street had its first indication that Enron and its leader didn't always play by the rules that were supposed to apply to publicly held corporations. Although it took place a long time ago, it seems obvious now that the Enron oil scandal was the canary in the coal mine. Okay, let's talk about that a little bit more. Like I mentioned, these Enron oil guys were making substantial profits for Enron when all the other divisions were losing money. So they basically thought they were untouchable. Then, in 1987, an Enron auditor got a tip from an employee at Apple Bank in New York, saying an unusual Enron account had been opened and there were millions of dollars flowing in from the Channel Islands and out to an Enron employee's account. Seems kind of fishy. As the investigation went up the chain, Borget, the guy in charge of Enron Oil, explained to Enron executives that his bosses had asked him to shift some profits from one quarter to another, and these offshore accounts was the method he was using to do it. The Enron auditors were ordered to turn the investigation over to Arthur Anderson, Enron's outside accountants. Anderson came up with some troubling findings. They couldn't verify the ownership of the offshore entities. The transactions had no purpose other than shifting profits, and Borget was destroying daily position reports, so Anderson couldn't verify if he was complying with the internal policy about the size of open positions. Anderson presented these findings to Enron, but basically left Enron to draw their own conclusions, and Enron concluded that this information wouldn't have a material impact on their financial statements, so they didn't have to disclose it. It's interesting that they determined there was no material impact, even though the transactions were conducted specifically to alter earnings. It's also interesting that nobody was punished. In Ken Lay's own words, "The traders make too much money to let them go." So the situation was basically swept under the rug until late 1987, when there was a problem that was too big to ignore. Borget had continually ignored internal trading limits and amassed a huge short position. Enron was in big trouble. To clean up the mess, Enron sent in Mike McElroy. McElroy was a former Navy SEAL who is now an Enron executive. McElroy quickly discovered that things were far worse than anyone realized. Enron oil was short over 84 million barrels. The position was so huge that it amounted to roughly 3 months' output of the gigantic North Sea oil field off the coast of England. If Enron were forced to cover its position, it would have been on the hook for well over $1 billion. Less than worthless was exactly the right description. When you added $1 billion plus to Enron's $4 billion in debt, the company's total debts outstripped its net worth. And of course, given how strapped the company was for cash, there was simply no way it could cover its trading losses without filing for bankruptcy. But Enron got lucky. Exactly the right person had gone to Valhalla to take charge of the problem. Experienced commodities trader that he was, McElroy took one look at Enron Oil's books and sat Mastroni down. Mastroni was the treasurer. "Unfortunately, I've had to kill people in my past," he told the terrified treasurer, "and I sleep like a baby." He demanded to see the real books. At 8 the next morning, Mastroni produced them. McElroy told Borget to leave the premises and asked Enron's security officer to change the locks on the door. Then he went to work. For the next 3 weeks, he and a small team of traders worked 18 to 20-hour days. His goal was to shrink the size of the position so that when the company finally had to settle up, the loss would at least be manageable. His only hope was to bluff his way out of his dilemma. If other traders knew what trouble Enron Oil was in, they were likely to bid the price of oil even higher. To fool them, McElroy pretended that Enron had crude oil in hand. He even bought some to sell into the market. The bluff bought him time. Within a few days, oil prices began to decline, or at least they fell enough that McElroy and his team were able to close down Enron Oil's positions, reducing the damage to the company to around $140 million instead of a billion. That still hurt, but it was no longer life-threatening. If the market moved up $3 more, Enron would have gone belly up, McElroy later said. Ken Lay never understood that. After almost a year of pretending in the face of overwhelming evidence that nothing was awry at Enron Oil, Ken Lay and the other Enron executives now had to pretend the opposite, that they were shocked, shocked by the actions of these rogue traders. The company announced that it would take an $85 million after-tax charge to 1987 earnings and blamed it on losses from unauthorized trading activity by two employees in its international crude oil trading subsidiary. So I'm sharing this whole story not because it has much to do with the later trouble Enron faced, but because it highlights the lack of ethical leadership from the top at Enron. They were okay with unethical or illegal activity when it benefited the company. But inevitably, if you allow this activity to occur in your company, it will eventually backfire. I like this quote from the book. "Any honest, competent management, confronted with the conduct of Borget and Mastroni, as revealed to Enron senior management in January 1987, would have fired these gentlemen without delay," wrote one lawyer. And this is a perfect illustration of our maxim that we've discussed in every single episode so far this season. Morals don't take vacations. If people are willing to be unethical in one situation, it will almost always translate to later indiscretions. This type of behavior should always be treated as an indicator and a warning. After they put the Enron oil mess behind them, Enron was still in need of a solid plan for making money in a deregulated energy industry. Jeff Skilling was the guy with that plan. The three names you probably think of when you hear Enron are Ken Lay, we already discussed him, Andrew Fastow, we'll get to him later, and Jeff Skilling. Let's take a few minutes to talk about Skilling. I'll set the scene with this passage from the book. When people describe Skilling, they don't just use the word smart. They use phrases like incandescently brilliant or the smartest person I ever met. Skilling in the late 1980s wasn't a physically striking man. He was smallish, a little pudgy, and balding, but his mental agility was breathtaking. He could process information and conceptualize ideas with blazing speed. He could instantly simplify highly complex issues into a sparkling, compelling image, and he presented his ideas with a certainty that bordered on arrogance and brooked no dissent. He used his brain power not just to persuade, but to intimidate. Without question, Skilling's formidable intelligence had a lot to do with turning Enron into a company that was successful, at least for a while. But he also had qualities that were disastrous for someone running a big company. For all his brilliance, Skilling had dangerous blind spots. His management skills were appalling, in large part because he didn't really understand people. He expected people to behave according to the imperatives of pure intellectual logic. But of course nobody does that, including, it should be said, Skilling himself. One former top executive recalls arguing with him constantly, struggling to explain, "Jeff, people will do things just because they're people." Skilling also had a tendency to oversimplify, and he largely disregarded, indeed he had an active distaste for, the messy details involved in executing a plan. What thrilled Skilling, always, was the intellectual purity of an idea, not the translation of that idea into reality. "Jeff Skilling is a designer of ditches, not a digger of ditches," an Enron executive said years later. "He was often too slow, even unwilling, to recognize when the reality didn't match the theory. Over time, his arrogance hardened, and he became so sure that he was the smartest guy in the room that anyone who disagreed with him was summarily dismissed as just not bright enough to get it." And there was one other thing about Skilling. For all his analytical abilities, he was a gambler at heart, and had been from an early age. He always assumed that he could beat the odds. In the end, that was Skilling's most dangerous blind spot of all. I love that description of Skilling. Let me explain how he ended up at Enron. As we saw in there, Skilling was smart and high-achieving, so naturally he went to Harvard Business School. After earning his MBA, he joined McKinsey around 1980, and by 1989, he was a director in charge of the Worldwide Energy and North America Chemical Practices. Unsurprisingly, he was spending a lot of his time working on Enron engagements. Around this time, the natural gas industry was facing a big problem, and Skilling thought he had found a big solution. He called it the gas bank. Here's a little background from the book. The biggest single issue facing the entire natural gas industry was astoundingly basic: the interaction between buyers and sellers. It wasn't all that long ago, you'll recall, that gas was sold under long-term contracts between producers, pipelines, and local utilities, with the price set by the government. But by the late 1980s, with the onset of deregulation, some 75% of all the natural gas sold in the country changed hands on the spot market during a frantic few days of deal doing at the end of every month. The problem with such a system was its inherent uncertainty. A sudden cold spell in the Northeast could cause prices to rise overnight, hurting consumers. A wave of warm weather could depress prices, causing the gas producers to lose money. Even though there was a glut of natural gas, big industrial customers couldn't be sure they would always be able to lock up as much supply as they needed from one month to the next. And it was a risky bet for a pipeline company to guarantee a long-term supply at a fixed price to a customer because the pipeline couldn't count on being able to secure a steady supply of gas at a price that would ensure a profit. No wonder many industrial users of natural gas were switching to oil and coal. No wonder they no longer viewed natural gas as a reliable fuel. As for the pipelines, they were struggling to make profits because the margins on spot market deals were so low. Indeed, by the late 1980s, Enron was trying to convince the industry to move back to longer-term contracts, just like in the old days, except the price would be negotiated between the parties rather than set by the government. Enter Skilling's Gas Bank. It was nothing less than the first serious effort to diminish the level of risk for everybody involved in natural gas transactions. The basic idea was this: producers, acting as depositors, would contract to sell their gas to Enron. Gas customers, the borrowers, would contract to buy their gas from Enron. Enron, the bank, would capture the profits between the price at which it had acquired the gas and the price at which it had promised to sell the gas, just as a bank earns the spread between what it pays depositors and what it charges borrowers. Everybody would be happy, so long as Enron had a balanced portfolio of contracts, that is, contracts to sell gas at a specific price were matched by contracts to acquire gas at a specific price, the spot market price of natural gas could go crazy, and it wouldn't matter. Enron would already have locked in the profits. Just as important for both sellers and buyers, the uncertainty of the spot market would be replaced by the contractual certainty that Skilling's gas bank offered. The concept was pure intellectually, Skilling has said. It made all the sense in the world. All right, so Skilling comes up with this seemingly brilliant idea and pitches it to Enron, who starts using the strategy pretty unsuccessfully. While it was a good idea, Enron was struggling to get producers to sign long-term contracts. These guys were wildcatters, and they had a gambler's mentality. They didn't want to sign a long-term contract if they thought they might be able to get a better price in the future. So it's at this point that Skilling leaves McKinsey and joins Enron because he thinks Enron's problem with the gas bank is that he's not running it. So Enron creates a division called Enron Finance for Skilling to run, and he gets what they call phantom equity in the division, basically meaning if it does well, he shares in the upside. What Skilling did next was actually pretty brilliant. He figured out that he could get producers to sign long-term contracts if he paid them up front. While these guys didn't want to commit to a certain price, they needed money to drill. At this particular time in Texas, banks weren't lending, so Enron offered the only source of cash, and this got producers to sign long-term contracts. And Enron actually had a major advantage over banks. They could be much more aggressive in giving out money because they already had signed contracts in hand to sell the gas. They weren't guessing about the price of the gas in the future. They had essentially already sold it. This move by Skilling was the last piece of the puzzle, and when it clicked into place, the gas bank began to work. With supply and price now guaranteed by contracts, natural gas became much more desirable and demand increased tremendously. But Skilling didn't stop here. He took these contracts and created a market to trade them. Here's another excerpt from the book. In a sense, Skilling's innovation had the effect of freeing natural gas from its physical qualities, from the constraints of molecules and movement. The gas bank had been a kind of physical hedge. Now trading took the next step. It freed Enron from having to own assets involved in the production and transportation of natural gas. In theory, instead of owning a portfolio of assets, natural gas reserves and pipelines, Enron could simply own a portfolio of contracts that would allow it to control the resources it needed. Instead of seeing a commitment to deliver natural gas as something that necessarily involved a pipeline, Enron saw it as a financial commitment. It was a whole new way of conceptualizing the business, one that in theory required less capital and therefore would enable better pricing and more flexibility for customers. Now, naturally, as soon as there was a trading market for these contracts, who do you think got in on the fun? Wall Street, of course. Back to the book here. Wall Street firms piled into the business, but Enron always had a huge advantage. Its immense network of physical assets, its ability to tie all the moving pieces together and provide physical delivery of the gas itself, and its long history in the gas business gave it insights its Wall Street competitors could never match. These, alas, were lessons Enron would one day forget. Remember that line, because we're going to come back to that idea later in the episode. But that was still in the future. For now, there was tremendous excitement in Skilling's group about what they were doing, and they brought to it a missionary zeal. Early employees in Skilling's division would always recall those days as pure magic, a time when anything seemed possible, and much of what they did turned to gold. Skilling himself was down to earth, accessible, and open to argument in a way he wasn't later. In the early days, we were printing money, Cliff Baxter later recalled. We saw things no one else could see. Amanda Martin, another former executive, added, "In the beginning, it was brilliant. We were riding a train. We were proselytizing. We were the apostles. We were right." It's worth briefly pointing out that comment about printing money because we've seen it before. Bernie Madoff's legitimate market-making business was printing money. And so was FTX. And that was before any funny business was taking place. It seems like in a lot of these frauds we discuss, the central characters find a way to take a good thing and make it bad due to greed. If you haven't had a chance to listen yet, I highly recommend going back and checking out episode 1 on Madoff and episode 3 on Sam Bankman-Fried and FTX. Okay, back to it here. So that was a glimpse into Skilling's early days at Enron. There's one more important point we need to cover before moving on, and that's Skilling's insistence that his business be allowed to use mark-to-market accounting. This was so important to Skilling that he refused to join Enron unless he was allowed to use this method. So what is mark-to-market accounting? If you're an accountant, bear with me here. I'm going to read a little excerpt from the book for the listeners who are like me and didn't study accounting. Because much of what happened at Enron can be traced to the decision to use mark-to-market accounting, it's important to take a moment to understand it. Suppose you've booked an asset and a liability on your balance sheet, for instance, a 10-year contract to supply natural gas to a utility in Duluth. Under conventional accounting, the value on your books continues to reflect your initial assumptions over the life of the deal, even if the underlying economics change. Using the concept of marking to market, however, you're forced to adjust the values on your balance sheet on a regular basis to reflect fluctuations in the marketplace or anything else that might change the values. That's the first big difference. Here's the second. When you use conventional accounting, you book the revenues and profits that flow from the contract as they come through the door. But under the mark-to-market method, you can book the entire estimated value for all 10 years on the day you sign the contract. Changes in that value show up as additional income or losses in subsequent periods. Okay, now that we understand what mark-to-market accounting is, the next question is, why did Skilling want to use it? And the main answer goes back to something we talked about earlier. Skilling was an idea guy. Jeff Skilling is a designer of ditches, not a digger of ditches. Remember that quote? Well, he fundamentally believed that a business should be able to declare profits when it came up with an idea, not when it executed that idea. Here's a good line from the book. Over time, this radical notion of value came to define the way Enron presented itself to the world, justifying the booking of millions in profits on a business before it had generated a penny in actual revenues. In Skilling's head, the idea, the vision, not the mundane reality, was always the critical thing. So Jeff, being an idea guy, I believe, was the main reason for wanting to use mark-to-market accounting. He also insisted that it more accurately reflected the company's finances than traditional accounting. This is true for something like a Wall Street trading company where their portfolio fluctuates daily and the changes are easy to measure. It is less true for a company like Enron, and it presents a number of issues and vulnerabilities. Here are a few excerpts that highlight those vulnerabilities. As we now know from painful experience, any accounting method is susceptible to abuse. And the natural gas business at this critical moment in its history was ripe for mark-to-market accounting abuse. Why? Because the value of natural gas contracts cannot be determined with the same precision that one can determine the price of a share of stock. Sure, you can gauge today's natural gas price precisely, and with the growth in NYMEX futures contracts, there is even a market price for gas, say, 12 months in the future. But natural gas contracts might have durations of 10, even 20 years, and who could say with any certainty what the price of gas was going to be 10 years from now? Yet to book all that revenue and profit up front, as mark-to-market accounting required, somebody at Enron had to estimate the price of gas 20 years hence. Even well-intentioned estimates might turn out to be completely wrong, and of course there would also be times when those estimates weren't so well-intentioned. Times when somebody needed a little extra income to make the earnings Enron promised Wall Street, or get paid a big bonus, or stash earnings away for a rainy day. Indeed, over the years, Enron extended mark-to-market accounting well beyond natural gas to other areas where the value was even more subjective, and abuse even more tempting. There are two other potential problems with mark-to-market accounting. The first is the mismatch between profits and cash. Just because a company can book 20 years worth of revenues and profits in one fell swoop doesn't mean it actually has the money in hand. On the contrary, even if everything happens precisely as predicted, the money rolls in quarter after quarter, year after year, for the duration of the contract. And so with mark-to-market accounting, there is often a large discrepancy between the profits the company is reporting to its shareholders and the cash it has on hand to run the business. Sure enough, Enron's financial filings soon included this phrase, recognized but unrealized income. In other words, Enron had booked the earnings, but it didn't yet have the cash. If the estimated value is correct, then over the life of the contract, the cash should equal the earnings. But the longer the term of the contract, the bigger the initial mismatch. And of course, you can't run a business on paper profits, at least not forever. The most dangerous problem of all is the very thing that makes mark-to-market accounting seem so seductive in the first place, growth. When the initial deals are cut and all the potential profits are immediately posted, a company using mark-to-market accounting appears to be growing rapidly. Wall Street analysts applaud and the stock rockets upward. But how do you keep that growth rate up? True, you're still receiving the cash from past contracts, but you can't count it in your profits because you've booked it already. It's as if you have to begin every quarter fresh. If you did one deal last quarter, in order to show growth, you have to do two the next, and four the quarter after that, and eight after that, and on and on. And if you're promising Wall Street that your earnings will increase at a 15% annual clip, well, soon enough, you're on a treadmill that becomes faster and steeper as the company gets bigger. And so those excerpts are foreshadowing of the problems to come at Enron. But for now, you have a good understanding of Skilling's arrival and early impact on the company. We'll circle back later and talk about how those chickens came home to roost. But for now, let's talk more about Enron's culture and growth. Specifically, I want to talk about Enron Capital and Trade Resources, or ECT. This was Skilling's group, and it was made up of three parts: trading, getting gas to customers, and financing. Before we talk about the business, let's talk a little bit about the culture Skilling instilled at ECT. The culture at ECT is important to understand because as Skilling rose through the ranks, he brought his people with him, the people who had come up in the ECT culture. And that explains a lot of what went wrong later. Skilling valued people with raw intelligence over those with management skills and experience. So he tended to hire MBAs from the best schools and then motivate them with money. Here's a description from the book. Skilling had other ideas too. He used to say that he liked to hire guys with spikes. By this, he meant that if an executive had a singular, narrow talent, a spike, Skilling was willing to bring him into Enron and lavish him with money, no matter what his other shortcomings. Egomaniacs, social misfits, backstabbers, devotees of strip clubs, Skilling didn't really care about their foibles so long as they had a skill he needed. Nor did it much matter to him whether they were team players. Jeff could care less whether people got along with each other, says one of his early hires. In many cases, he felt it was better if they didn't get along, since it created a level of tension that he believed was good for helping people come up with new ideas. A former trading executive adds, Jeff always believed pitting three people against each other would be the quickest way to assure the best ideas bubble to the top. He wanted them to fight. They were all smart, of course. That went without saying. Every person around Skilling was exceptional in one way or another, says a former longtime executive. Did they have the skills to run a very complex business? Ha! Which offers up the problem. No company can prosper over the long term if every employee is a free agent, motivated solely by greed, no matter how smart he is. No company can function if it only hires brilliant MBAs and sets them against each other. There's a reason companies value team players, just as there's a reason that people who can get along with others tend to do well in corporate life. The reason is simple. You can't build a company on brilliance alone. You need people who can come up with ideas, and you also need people who can implement those ideas and are well compensated for doing so. The pure meritocracy Skilling thought he was installing was, in fact, a deeply dysfunctional workplace. That was hard to see in the early days, when the place felt vibrant and heady and exciting, and they were all working so hard that they didn't have time for anything else. But over the years, as the business became more established, the sense of excitement waned, and the dysfunction became more evident. The very qualities Skilling prized, the opportunity for creativity to run wild, the mixture of brains and hubris, the absence of gray hair and structure, turned Enron Finance into a chaotic, destructive free-for-all. Over time, as that culture infected the entire company, Enron began to rot from within. So that gives you a general idea of the culture, but this will give you a more specific sense. The man who offers perhaps the starkest illustration of what Skilling valued in an employee was an executive named Lou Pai, the key architect of Enron's trading operation, who was later placed in charge of several other key Skilling initiatives. Pai, who carefully measured his words, was viewed as an enigma by his coworkers and as a terrible man to cross. More than anyone else, he became the instrument of Skilling's will. But Enron executives knew him for something else: his longtime infatuation with strippers. A married middle-aged father of two, Pai maintained an ongoing secret relationship with an exotic dancer he'd met during one of his frequent visits to topless bars. Few other American corporations would have tolerated Pai's antics, inside or outside the office. Indeed, several times Skilling contemplated firing Pai in his first years of the company, but once he proved himself on the trading desk, Pai became untouchable. Skilling gave him complete freedom to run trading as he saw fit, and no matter how much he abused his colleagues or underlings, he almost never reined him in. But why? Why was Skilling so loyal to Pi, so willing to allow his greed and poisonous tactics to shape the culture of ECT? Skilling's response was simple. He left Pi alone because he always got the job done. So that's concerning, and it's a little glimpse into things to come. But for now, let's talk about the business. Remember, it was three parts: trading, getting gas to customers, and financing. We're going to start with getting gas to customers. That involved two pieces: the gas bankers and the marketers. The gas bankers were the ones who struck deals with the producers to lock up long-term supply. The marketers were on the other side. They were making deals with utilities and other big buyers of natural gas. The goal for the marketers was always to create new demand for natural gas, and one of the ways they did that was with the Scythe deal. They convinced Scythe Energies to build a power plant run on natural gas instead of coal. Enron was their gas supplier for a 20-year contract worth between $3.5 and $4 billion. As you'll remember from earlier in our discussion, mark-to-market accounting allowed Enron to start booking profits from the deal immediately. Now let's talk about the second part of the business, trading. Trading was actually intertwined with the gas bankers and the marketers. It sat between the two of them. You see, the gas bankers were responsible for locking up supply, but they typically couldn't buy enough supply to service the full contracts the marketers were selling. That's where the traders came in. They would trade contracts on the open market to hedge Enron's risk and ensure they were able to buy gas for less than they were selling it so they could make money on these long-term deals. It wasn't possible to know the price of gas 20 years in the future, so the traders were responsible for managing this risk. This arrangement gave ECT traders a huge advantage over their competitors because they had access to information from the gas bankers and the marketers, information that was not available to most of the other traders in the market. This should have been a win-win-win situation for everyone. But hang on for a second. You remember that culture I told you about a few minutes ago? Here's where it started to come into play. Check out this excerpt from the book. If it meant more money for him and his group, Pi was more than willing to cheat his ECT brethren. One former trading executive recalls that when finance executives approached him on the trading floor to obtain prices for selling the gas they'd acquired from a producer, Pi, behind his back, would secretly signal thumbs down, meaning that the trader should quote a below-market price. And when a marketing originator came to the trader to get a price for buying gas, Pi would give a thumbs up to quote an above-market price. The effect of this would be to steal some of the expected profit spread for the trading desk from the dealmakers. The line is, you show them the same price you'd show anyone else that called on the phone or better, says the trading executive. If you're showing them a worse price than you show Morgan Stanley, you're screwing them. Lou took me aside on more than one occasion for not taking enough money out of the transaction for the trading desk. Of all the corrosive things Lou Pi did at Enron, nothing did more to emphasize the mercenary nature of life at Enron and undermine any vestige of teamwork. But Skilling, ever the believer in creative tension, didn't see a problem. So these are clearly zero-sum, short-term games that are being incentivized by this culture. And that's obviously not a good way to build a long-term thriving company. Another quick point on culture here. Skilling implemented a review process called the Performance Review Committee. It was referred to as the PRC. It was basically a peer review system that took place every 6 months. Here's a little excerpt highlighting how this contributed to the culture. Twice a year, every ECT employee, except Skilling, from managing director down to secretary, underwent individual review. It began with extensive written feedback reports from bosses and colleagues that assessed their performance on 5 sets of criteria. The real action took place at a string of marathon sessions held at local hotels, where panels would debate and rank each employee on a scale of 1 to 5, 1 being the best and 5 the worst, while the individual's photo was projected on a screen in front of the group. Most of the ranking categories involved collaborative qualities such as teamwork and interpersonal, and communication/setting direction. What really counted, though, was the bottom line. If they were making money and being total jerks to people, we'd always forgive them for that, says one early ECT executive. They might be a 5 in teamwork, but if they were a 1 in earnings, they were a 1. If you weren't doing deals, we had trouble valuing your contribution to the company. All of these points on culture highlight a maxim we've discussed on every single episode so far, and that we even mentioned earlier in this episode. Morals don't take vacations. Skilling encouraged poor morals and ethics, if not directly, certainly through incentives he created. Between the cutthroat competitions, buying loyalty with money, being mean to coworkers, and exploiting other team members to guarantee more for yourself, the culture was toxic. What we've learned from studying other frauds is that if someone is willing to treat people poorly or make shady deals in one situation, they'll probably do it in any situation. And those people are best to be avoided. A company is nothing more than a collection of people. So if enough people at a company lack morals, then that culture takes over and the company itself becomes immoral. If you can spot these little indicators, you'll save yourself a lot of money and heartache by simply walking the other way. Okay, the third part of the ECT business I haven't talked about yet is the financing piece. Enron leadership told Skilling that ECT needed to fund its own growth. Skilling was spending a lot of money to grow his business, and he didn't have the cash flow to fund it. Even though they were signing big deals and reporting big profits, again, thanks to mark-to-market accounting, the cash flow from those deals was in the future. That wouldn't help him fund the business now. Borrowing from banks was also off the table because Enron already had a lot of debt. In creating the gas bank, Skilling had taken a page out of the financial industry playbook, so he went back to that playbook when he needed to fund ECT, and he came up with securitization. ECT basically packaged the loans they were making to producers. This was the money they were fronting to people who were supplying the gas. They packaged these up, put them into a special purpose entity, and sold shares in the SPEs to investors like General Electric. As part of the deal, the investors would sell the gas from the producers back to ECT, who would in turn sell it to their utilities customers with whom they already had contracts. So how did this help ECT? Well, it removed debt from their balance sheet, and it gave them cash to run the business, solving Skilling's problem of funding his own growth. Two things to remember here. First is the idea of special purpose entities, and second is the fact that these first SPEs were set up by Andrew Fastow. We're going to come back to both of these points later, so don't forget them. All right, let's round out this section with another excerpt from the book. With the financial piece in place, nothing could stop ECT, and nothing did. By 1996, in its sixth full year of existence, Skilling's division made $280 million before interest and taxes, more than 20% of Enron's earnings. Trading was rapidly becoming the company's biggest profit center. At the same time, Skilling was firmly established as the company's resident genius. Everyone believed what he said because he hadn't been wrong, recalls one ECT executive. So I wanted to read you that little piece because it reminded me of something we talked about in the FTX episode. That was episode 3 if you want to go back and listen. There was a situation where Alameda Research couldn't find $4 million worth of assets, and Sam basically told everyone, don't worry, it'll turn up. Eventually it did turn up, and this bolstered all the employees' confidence in Sam, even though they didn't know why he was right. It seems like sometimes when you have exceptionally smart individuals like Skilling or SBF, they can use their raw intelligence to intimidate everyone else around them into just believing them. This is troublesome because it creates a dynamic where the smart leader is basically accountable to no one. I think this is something to be wary of. You shouldn't be following someone simply because they're brilliant or because they haven't been wrong yet. If they're actually brilliant, they should be able to explain their thinking in a way that makes sense. Leaning on their superior intelligence as a justification for why they do things is a red flag, not something to be impressed by. Next, I want to talk about Enron International. This was a different business line, but it's important to understand how it worked because, like the culture we discussed in ECT, many of the things that happened in EI contributed to later trouble at Enron. All right, I want to tell you about Rebecca Mark. She didn't start EI, but she's really the only name you need to know when it comes to EI. This is from the book. Until the mid-1990s, most people who had heard of Enron had no idea who Jeff Skilling was. To the outside world, the person who was Enron, who had a reputation for turning impossible concepts into glittering realities, was not Skilling. It was Rebecca Mark. When she stepped off Enron jets in remote spots in third world countries, she was welcomed like a celebrity and surrounded by throngs of reporters. Mark was a high-profile woman in a very male industry at a time when building power plants and pipelines across the globe was thought to be one of the most glamorous, profitable businesses ever. A little like the internet in the late 1990s. And she reveled in it, embraced it with every fiber of her being. In her ambition, her drive, and her tenacity, says a former Enron executive, she was truly spectacular. So that's a quick glimpse into who Mark was, but what about the business she was running? Enron International was in the business of developing power projects in emerging markets. More specifically, they were building or buying pipelines and power plants in countries like Argentina, the Philippines, Guatemala, China, Indonesia, and more. By the mid-90s, Mark was in charge of more than a dozen projects costing billions of dollars, but her business was littered with problems, most of which can be traced back to bad incentives surrounding deal-making. Here's an explanation from the book. The most poisonous explanation for the mad rush to do deals was money. Not the money Enron would make, but the money the developers would make. What one former international executive calls the fatal flaw in the business was the compensation structure. Developers got bonuses on a project-by-project basis. The developers would calculate the present value of all the expected future cash flow from a project. This was also the model the banks used to lend money. When the project reached financial close, that is, when the banks lent money, but before a single pipe was laid or foundation was poured, they were paid, they being the developers. No wonder the developers were so eager to move on to the next deal. They had no financial incentive to follow through on the one they'd just completed, and the money they stood to make was stunning, amounting to some 9% of the project's total value. In other words, if the developers estimated that the project would ultimately bring Enron $100 million, the developers took home $9 million. In a sense, they were being paid on the basis of mark-to-market accounting, just like the traders in Skilling's group. It was crazy. The only thing that mattered was making the deal happen. The more deals Enron International did, and the bigger they were, the richer the developers got. The system encouraged international executives to gamble without risk. The deeper problem, one that emerged in later years, was that no one was held responsible for the operation of a project, yet it was the operation that produced the real money. So the executives in EI were incentivized to close deals no matter how bad the deal was, because they got paid for closing it, not making sure it was ultimately a successful venture. Like I said earlier, most of the problems in the group came back to this bad incentive structure. Let's talk about a few of them. One problem was how they underwrote the deals. Here's an example from the book. The assumptions Enron made to justify its deals assumed that nothing would ever go wrong. Of course, the banks financing the deals were making the same assumption. This was a mania, after all. But building energy projects in poor countries, often run by dictators and where capitalism was still a new concept, was absolutely fraught with peril, and it was absurd to believe that everything would play out according to plan. Things went wrong all the time. Who could say for sure that a plant in the wilds of Brazil that wasn't even supposed to be operational for years would ever generate the monster profits Enron was anticipating? What if there were cost overruns? What if Brazilians couldn't afford the cost of the new energy? What if the government decided to nationalize the project? With every emerging markets project, there were a million what-ifs. Take the Dominican Republic, where Enron had invested $95 million to own 50% of a barge-mounted plant off Puerto Plata on the northern coast. It turned out the Dominican Republic wouldn't pay for the power. The plant was next to a hotel called the Hotelero del Atlantico. The prevailing winds blew soot from the plant onto the guests' meals, blackening their food, and not in a stylish way. The winds also blew garbage from nearby slums into the plant's water intake system. For some time, the only solution was to hire men who paddled out to the intake valve in boats, where they would push the garbage away with their paddles. In 1995, the hotel sued, alleging damages and loss of customers. For Enron, the deal was a complete bust. Through mid-2000, the company had collected a pathetic $3.5 million from its $95 million investment. So underwriting was obviously a problem, but so was financing. Here's another excerpt. One of the core ideas behind Mark's business was that most of the money for the projects it put together would come from non-Enron sources, from bank loans to governments, say, or investments from companies hankering to get in on the emerging markets gold rush. That would keep debt off Enron's balance sheet and put a minimal amount of Enron's own capital at risk. But in the rush to do deals, that wasn't always the case, and Enron often ended up guaranteeing some or all of the debt, at least for a time. For the Subic Bay, Philippines plant that Enron was developing, the company guaranteed all $105 million in debt. On a second Philippines plant, Enron guaranteed 25% of the principal and interest on a $50 million loan. In addition, Enron provided tens of millions of dollars in letters of credit to support cost overruns. One executive remembers that on one project, the banks had a list of conditions that, once they were met, would eliminate the need for an Enron guarantee. But no one at Enron bothered to meet the conditions and thereby get rid of the guarantee. That last sentence is really important. No one at Enron bothered to meet the conditions and thereby get rid of the guarantee. This is a theme across the Enron business lines and is one we'll see pop up again later. Execution isn't something they really care about at all. Getting the deal done is their concern, but unfortunately, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, execution and operation are what actually bring in the money. Two other things we should talk about quickly. The first is bad accounting. When Enron spent money on a deal that never materialized, they were supposed to write off that money. Instead, they would book it as an asset. For example, they spent $18 million in Vietnam trying to build a power plant, but the plant never actually happened. They justified booking this as an asset because there was no official letter saying the project was dead. These type of quote-unquote assets eventually represented more than $200 million on their books. So this is a little more foreshadowing of future unethical slash illegal accounting. The second thing I need to mention is a project called Dabhole. We don't need to go into the details of Dabhole, but you need to know this was an energy plant that Enron built in India, which had a notoriously terrible energy market for foreign investors. Everyone else just avoided the country. As you might expect, the Dabhole plant was a failure. This single sentence from the book captures it well. Today, Dabhole, in which Enron invested some $900 million, sits silent, a gigantic, wasted marvel of modern technology. Now that you understand a little bit about Enron International, you can see how it added to the glamour of Enron at the time, but you can also probably guess how it contributed to the downfall. Next, I want to talk about Enron's obsession with their stock price. There are a couple things we need to understand here. First, Ken Lay was the CEO. Remember we talked about him earlier? Well, he wasn't really running the company. He spent most of his time schmoozing, playing politics in Washington, sitting on the boards of other companies, and generally just crafting his image as a public figure. He had aspirations to eventually be the Treasury Secretary. Lay was also regarded as a poor manager. He didn't like speaking candidly to people, and he allowed nepotism to run through the company. So who was actually running the place? That would be a guy named Rich Kinder. If the name sounds familiar, it's because he eventually left Enron and started a company called Kinder Morgan, which is still around today. The second thing you need to understand is the executive comp structure at Enron. Obviously, most of the executives had bundles of Enron stock, so when the price went up, so did their net worth. But check out this passage from the book. For Kinder and Lay, it was even more explicit. It was written into their employment agreements. In early 1994, the Enron board awarded the two men enormous options packages, 1.2 million options for Lay and another million for Kinder. The vast majority of the options, 80%, did not vest until the year 2000, but there was another provision. If Enron delivered at least 15% annual growth, a third of their options would vest each year. That one clause was worth millions to each man. So those are some pretty strong incentives to ensure 15% growth. If you had to guess, how much do you think Enron's earnings grew every year during that time period? Let's go back to the book and answer that question. 15% a year. That's what Enron was promising investors, that its earnings per share would grow at a clip of 15% a year. That was an admittedly aggressive target. But if Enron could deliver, the company would be handsomely rewarded. Companies that grow at double-digit rates are classified by investors as growth companies, and they tend to have higher stock valuations than slower-growing companies. This was never truer than during the bull market of the 1990s, an era when growth companies were the only kind of companies investors wanted to buy. Internet stocks were growth companies, of course, and so were big technology companies like Microsoft and Cisco and Sun Microsystems. Every company, it seemed, was striving to become known as a growth company. The problem is that whenever a growth company disappoints Wall Street, when it announces earnings that don't meet the aggressive target it has set for itself, the punishment is usually severe. As rapidly as growth stocks can run up when the news is good, they can spiral downward just as quickly when the news is bad. So in the era of growth companies, Enron decided they were going to be a growth company too. The trouble with that decision is that it didn't align with reality when you looked at Enron's business. Let's look at a few examples. Their pipeline business was profitable and growing, but nowhere near 15% per year. Rebecca Mark's international projects that we talked about earlier were expected to make a lot of money, but most of them still weren't off the ground. Enron had an exploration division that had huge profits some years and huge losses others. And then there was Skilling's division, ECT. They were generating fast-growing earnings, but they were a trading business, and trading businesses are inherently volatile. They also grow less as competitors enter the market and the market becomes more efficient. So how did Enron hit their growth targets and remain a growth company? Back to the book here. Given the kind of company Enron was, the bar was hard to jump over consistently. And thus did Enron begin turning to aggressive accounting tactics, tactics that planted those dangerous seeds. The things Enron did in those early years were not illegal, nor did they push the boundaries anywhere near as far as it did later in the decade, but they did help mask certain unpleasant financial realities, and they pushed the company into accounting's gray zone. Kinder, though, had a sense of where the limits were, and he knew how to maintain control. Had he stayed, Enron's highs would never have been as high, but the lows would never have been as low. That last sentence was a bit of foreshadowing. Kinder ended up leaving in 1996, and then the wheels started coming off. But let's look at a few of the aggressive accounting tactics Enron started employing under Kinder. This is from the book again. One way Enron managed its earnings, even then, was by reworking its long-term supply contracts, which would then allow it to post additional earnings thanks to mark-to-market accounting. The company also sold assets and made other non-recurring moves to meet its earning targets, but it didn't always label these as non-recurring events. Enron simply declared them as part of its ongoing operations. For instance, between 1994 and 1996, Enron reduced its stake in Teesside, which was a power plant, from 50% to 28% and folded the gains it reaped from selling the stake into its earnings. Back in 1989, Enron had raised needed cash by selling a minority stake in Enron Oil and Gas through a public offering. 6 years later, the company sold more oil and gas shares to the public, generating an additional $367 million in pre-tax profits. So those moves are all pretty questionable, but then they pulled this stunt. In 1994, they created a spin-off company called EPP. The purpose was to buy Enron International's assets, Mark's development projects, in order to take them off Enron's books and realize the profits up front. But there was a problem with this plan. The contracts for the international deals required that Enron remain an owner, but accounting rules required that if Enron controlled EPP, then they couldn't realize profits when they sold the assets to EPP. Let's jump back to the book to see how Enron navigated these tricky waters. Enron and its accountants at Arthur Andersen and its lawyers at the blue-chip Houston firm of Vinson and Elkins managed to find a way. Enron, they decided, would retain slightly more than 50% of the assets, but it would set up an oversight committee consisting of three directors who would independently approve every transaction. Astonishingly, Arthur Andersen agreed that this would mean Enron didn't control EPP and could therefore book profits when it sold assets to EPP. It was, all in all, a remarkably sleazy solution. For their work, Arthur Anderson was paid $750,000, and Vincent and Elkins was paid $1.2 million. And the chairman of EPP? That was Rich Kinder. In November 1994, EPP sold stock to the public at a price of $24 a share, raising a total of $225 million, money that bolstered Enron's 1994 earnings. So what's happening here is something I like to call consultant capture. It's kind of like regulatory capture, where a company is so powerful that it's writing the regulations for its industry. Well, Enron was such a big client of both Arthur Anderson and Vincent and Elkins that Enron essentially controlled them. These consultants didn't want to risk losing their biggest cash cow accounts, so they would basically do whatever Enron asked of them, even when it was unethical or even illegal. We'll see this idea come up a bunch more times in our discussion. Now, you might be asking yourself, Enron was a publicly traded company. How did nobody know about these shenanigans? That's a great question. The answer is, people did know. Here's another excerpt. Were these transactions hidden from the investing public? No. Enron's brass didn't go out of their way to point them out, but for anyone willing to wade through the company's financial documents, the numbers were clear. From time to time, an analyst would ask some tough questions, or a reporter would write a story that raised what would seem now to be obvious objections to Enron's modus operandi. In 1993, Tony Mack published a story in Forbes entitled Hidden Risks, in which she questioned the use of mark-to-market accounting in Skilling's business. If you accelerate your income, then you have to keep doing more and more deals to show the same or rising income, an Enron competitor told Mack. A few years later, a journalist named Harry Hurt III wrote an article in Fortune about, as he put it, Enron's allegedly Byzantine methods of managing earnings. Hurt noted that when you stripped out a few of the one-time gains from Enron's seemingly healthy 1995 earnings, including the profit Enron recorded for selling shares of Enron Oil and Gas, 1995 hadn't been such a good year after all. Without those gains, Enron's profits actually fell. But stories like that were soon forgotten. Investigative journalism. This is something we also saw with Madoff. Skeptical journalists published articles posing important questions and pointing out anomalies, but they were largely ignored. In Madoff's case, one of these articles even landed on the desk at the SEC, but they didn't even open an investigation. Go back and check out episode 1 on Madoff if you want to learn more about this. There's a really interesting contradiction we've seen again and again when it comes to media. When the media praises people or companies, the investing public eats it up. They use it as a proxy for trust. They use it as an excuse to back up the truck and buy more. This was true with Elizabeth Holmes, who we talked about in episode 2, and Sam Bankman-Fried, who we talked about in episode 3, who were both on the cover of Forbes and applauded in the media. But then on the other hand, when investigative journalists raised important questions, people tend to ignore them, as they did with Madoff, as they did with Enron. Because we've seen this repeatedly, we have a maxim for it. Praise is noise, skeptics are signal. In other words, ignore praise and pay attention to investigative journalism. This seems to be a very reliable approach when it comes to the fraudsters we've studied. All right, so now we have a pretty solid understanding of the Enron obsession with the stock price. Executive comp was heavily tied to stock price growth. Enron wanted to position themselves as a growth company, even though their business model didn't align with it. They started taking accounting liberties to keep achieving growth. And then Rich Kinder, basically the only person keeping the madness in check, left the company. You can imagine how things might begin to unravel. Okay, now that Kinder was out, who do you think took his place? You guessed it, Skilling. This is from the book. Inevitably, now that he was in charge, Skilling began the process of refashioning Enron in his image, or rather, in the image of ECT. He would jettison those divisions that didn't fit his vision of what an Enron business should be and start exciting new ones to take their place. He would emphasize intellectual capital and promote risk-taking, and he would make sure to place his loyalists in key spots all over the company. Thus, it wasn't long before Lou Pye, Ken Rice, Cliff Baxter, and other important ECT managers were handed senior positions at Enron, along with big raises and more stock options. By the end of Skilling's first year, Skillingites filled 11 of the 26 slots on Enron's management committee, including such disparate positions as finance and governmental affairs. Making Enron more like ECT meant creating new, modern businesses while putting less emphasis on the old legacy operations like pipelines and natural gas production, which Kinder had always loved. Skilling's original idea to trade natural gas contracts had been such a huge triumph, bringing not only earnings but acclaim, that one could hardly blame him for wanting to replicate it. But his vision also grew out of necessity. As early as 1993, profit margins in the gas trading operation had begun to slip as competitors such as the Natural Gas Clearinghouse, El Paso, and a host of others had flooded into the business, establishing their own gas trading desks. What's more, the basic business had changed. No longer did gas producers need Enron to front them money. The banks were making loans again and squeezing Enron out. And at the other end of the business, big industrial users of natural gas were far less interested in signing long-term origination deals with Enron, like the old Scythe Agreement. After all, they could use their own traders. So even though Enron had become the biggest player in the business of buying and selling natural gas contracts, controlling some 20% of the market, Skilling was fretting about the future. His solution? To do even more trading and extend it beyond natural gas. He wanted Enron to trade electric power. This was his next big idea. I've mentioned this on nearly every episode, and I'm going to mention it again. This move by Skilling to trade electricity reminds me of Morgan Housel's article, Degrees of Confidence. The idea is basically that as you get really good at something, you mistakenly assume that your skill translates to other areas. This rarely leads to a good outcome. I'm going to link that article in the show notes in case you want to read it. And speaking of mistakenly assuming that your skill translates to other areas, Skilling did just that. He took his success in natural gas trading and decided he could apply it to electricity. But electricity and natural gas were two entirely different beasts, as Skilling would come to learn. Enron had been positioned for success in natural gas trading because they were an insider in the industry. They owned pipelines and they had direct relationships with producers and consumers. In the electricity industry, they were outsiders. They had no information advantage and no relationships to leverage. Another problem, the logistics of transporting electricity were more complicated than gas. The lines were controlled by the utilities, and the utilities made it hard for outsiders to participate. Finally, unlike natural gas, electricity can't be stored, which means the prices are much more volatile. Just to summarize here, Enron had an information disadvantage, a logistics disadvantage, and a relationship disadvantage in a highly volatile industry. Seems like maybe they should have passed on this one. But instead of passing, Skilling insisted on buying his way into the club. So Skilling sent his people looking for a utility to buy, and Enron ended up buying basically the only utility that was willing to sell to them, Portland General. Enron bought Portland General for a 46% premium to its market price. Portland General gave Enron access to the California market, a market that had passed retail deregulation, as well as a supply of electricity to trade. The other thing that Skilling did was purge Enron businesses that didn't fit his vision of the future. One of those businesses was Enron Oil and Gas, or EOG as it was known. EOG was its own publicly traded company, but Enron owned the majority of the shares. EOG was in the business of drilling wells and prospecting for oil and gas, and apparently it was the best run part of Enron. From 1987, when Forrest Hoglund took over EOG, until the late 90s when Enron sold it, Hoglund tripled EOG's production and cut their costs significantly. But Skilling didn't see the value in it anymore. He thought if Enron needed gas supply, they could just get it through trading. So Enron sold its stake in EOG, mostly back to EOG, and within a year, EOG was trading at twice the price Enron had sold it for. As the authors wrote in the book, in his eagerness to unload Enron's EOG stake, Skilling had left more than $1 billion on the table. So the moral of this story is that Skilling took over after Kinder left, and he proceeded to axe businesses that were working in favor of new ventures that were risky long shots. This was only the beginning of the madness. We've already talked about the stock price, but it's such an important part of the story, we're going to talk about it again. Before we do, I want to tell you about the RAC. This is from the book. When reporters and analysts inquired about the company's risk management abilities, Skilling had a ready answer. He pointed to Enron's Risk Assessment and Control Department, known inside the company as RAC. Though Skilling had had small risk management teams at ECT, he set up RAC as a standalone unit in 1996. Skilling knew Wall Street wanted to see a strong system of internal controls, and after he was named president, he made RAC a centerpiece of management presentations to Wall Street analysts, investors, and credit rating agencies. RAC was the part of the company that had the analytical skills, and presumably the authority, to prevent Enron from doing anything stupid. Skilling imposed a requirement that RAC had to review virtually all Enron deals, even international ones, and he bragged constantly about the sophisticated oversight that RAC provided, which he portrayed as sacred. Only two things at Enron are not subject to negotiation: the firm's personnel evaluation policy and its company-wide risk management program, Skilling told a corporate finance journal. On paper, RAC sounded terrific. Its mission was to assess the economic, financial, credit, and political risk in every Enron deal of more than $500,000. Its analysts pored over numbers, challenged assumptions, tested models, checked price curves, and monitored portfolios. It employed former bankers, accountants, statistical wizards, and MBAs, a crack team of experts in every aspect of a commercial transaction. RAC had resources, too. By the late 1990s, a $30 million budget, access to a $600 million computer system, and 150 professionals. Most of all, as Enron described it, RAC had independence and clout. The formal mechanism for expressing its findings was a document called a Deal Approval Sheet, or a DASH. The DASH, which contained space for signatures of everyone who needed to approve the project, summarized the deal, the range of projected returns, and the risks that it presented. Later iterations of the form included a box for RAC's recommendation. It could approve the transaction, or it could tell management, do not proceed. The top man at RAC was Rick Bai, who had joined Skilling at ECT in 1994 after years as a vice president in the energy department at Bankers Trust. Bai was named the company's chief risk officer in 1998 and promoted to senior vice president of Enron in early 1999 at the age of 46. Skilling described Bai as Enron's top cop and frequently pointed out that he reported regularly to the audit committee of the Enron board. No one flat out declared that RAC had veto power over a deal, but this was, after all, Enron's control group. The implication was clear. If Bai thought a deal was too risky, Enron wouldn't do it. Thanks to RAC, Enron was able to portray itself as a company that could safely take on more risk than other companies, precisely because it had the right controls in place. So that gives you a good idea of how the RAC worked in theory, how Enron portrayed the RAC to the outside world, but inside the company, the reality was totally different. Rick Bai, the guy running RAC, didn't have the personality to stand up to the dealmakers. These guys were ruthless, and they always found a way to force deals through the RAC. What made matters even harder for the RAC was another case of bad incentives. Remember how we talked about the performance review process earlier? Well, the dealmakers sat on the panels that evaluated the RAC employees who were supposed to be reviewing their deals. And if an RAC employee killed a deal, that dealmaker would come after him in performance review meetings. For RAC executives, this could mean a six-figure difference in their annual bonuses. So they were not incentivized to protect Enron. They were incentivized to keep the dealmakers happy. Here's one example from the book of how ineffective the RAC was at mitigating risk. There were times when frustrated RAC executives refused to sign off on a bad deal, but Bai would overrule them. In 1998, John Hopley, who served for 4 years as one of Bai's top deputies, opposed a deal promoted by ECT executives in Europe, who wanted to invest about $20 million in a British company named Techboard, which made fiberboard for kitchen cabinets. Hopley opposed the deal because the company was in the British equivalent of bankruptcy, and even the originator's projected returns, which assumed the company would be able to navigate its way out of the mess, were small. He refused to sign the dash, so Bai signed it instead. 3 months after signing the agreement, the company went into liquidation, and Enron wrote off its entire $20 million investment. Rick and the group were under a tremendous amount of pressure, says a former RAC executive, but Bai, he adds, was not as forceful as he could have been in laying down the law. Now, this difference between the outside perception of the RAC and the reality inside the company was a huge problem, because analysts were factoring the RAC into their assessments of Enron. Listen to this example from the book. Wall Street was dazzled. "We rely heavily on Enron's risk management ability," Todd Shipman, an analyst with the Standard & Poor's credit rating agency, told Fortune. "You can't overemphasize how important that is. It's the underpinning to everything. It gives you a nice, warm, fuzzy feeling. Even though they're taking more risk, their market presence and risk management skills allow them to get away with it. Enron has such extraordinary risk management capabilities that we look at them differently." So one of the guys responsible for rating Enron's credit is basically saying that Enron takes a huge amount of risk, but they mitigate it better than anyone else. This is just one of a million examples of how Enron misled basically everyone. Final point on this. Skilling was responsible for the RAC's ineffectiveness. He put Rick Bai in charge knowing that Bai would be a yes man and that this would give Skilling free rein to do basically whatever risky deals he wanted while still being able to say, "But look, we mitigated our risk." Okay, as promised, let's go back to the stock price obsession. Here's a quick excerpt from the book. "And always, hovering over everything and everyone at Enron, was Wall Street. During the Kinder era, of course, Enron executives had cared a great deal about pleasing the street and watching the stock move upward. In the Skilling era, the stock became something else entirely. It became Enron's obsession. A stock ticker in the headquarters lobby offered a constant update on the price of Enron shares. TV monitors broadcast CNBC in the building elevators. Employees were repeatedly encouraged to buy Enron shares. On average, they kept more than half of their 401k retirement holdings in Enron shares. In 1998, when the stock price hit $50, Skilling and Lay treated it as a major corporate milestone, handing out $50 bills to every Enron employee. Later, Lay announced a new personnel initiative. If the company hit performance targets over several years, every employee would get twice his annual salary in Enron shares." So that was the environment at the company, and to keep the stock price growing, Enron had to continually increase earnings. But the problem was, they were mainly a trading company, and trading is a volatile business, as we've discussed already. So Skilling always insisted that Enron was a logistics company. They simply found the most efficient way to deliver power from any plant to any customer. Now, this was partially true, but it was very, very misleading. Enron was, at its heart, a trading company. Here's something else Skilling did. This is from the book. Skilling's method of arriving at Enron's quarterly and annual targets was downright perverse. Instead of going through a rigorous budget process and arriving at a number by analyzing all the business units and their prospects for the coming year, as Kinder used to do, he would impose a number based solely on what Wall Street wanted. He would openly ask the stock analysts, "What earnings do you need to keep our stock price up?" And the number he arrived at was the number Wall Street was looking for, regardless of whether internally it made any sense. Invariably, as the quarter drew to a close, Enron's top executives would realize that they were going to fall short of the number they'd promised Wall Street. At most companies, when this happens, the CEO and chief financial officer make an announcement ahead of time, warning analysts and investors that they're going to miss their number. In other words, the reality of the business drives the process of dealing with Wall Street, not at Enron. Enron's reality began and ended with hitting the target. And so, when the realization took place that the company was falling short, its executives undertook a desperate scramble to fill the holes in the company's earnings. At Enron, that's what they called earnings shortfalls, holes. Let me tell you about some of the shenanigans they pulled to fill these holes at quarter end. They often accelerated deal closings just to post earnings by the end of the quarter, but this often meant giving their counterparts better terms, which would inevitably cost Enron in the long run. They also expanded their use of mark-to-market accounting. This is from the book. Originally, mark-to-market had been used only in the accounting of natural gas futures contracts. That, after all, is what the Securities and Exchange Commission had agreed to back in 1991. Over the years, Enron had quietly extended the practice. By 1997, Enron had extended mark-to-market accounting to every portion of its merchant business. It even began using the approach to book profits on private equity and venture capital investments, where values were extraordinarily subjective. By the end of the decade, some 35% of Enron's assets were being given mark-to-market treatment. Another trick they used was reinterpreting old contracts. By changing some of the assumptions, they could squeeze more earnings out of a contract, much like you can wring water out of a damp rag. Enron also had a bunch of private equity investments, and when they needed more earnings, they would simply mark up the value of these investments, as they alluded to in that excerpt we just read. And they would also delay recording losses. Here's one more excerpt. At the end of each quarter, for example, Enron was supposed to write off its dead deals. To review what needed to be booked, Causey met individually with the heads of the origination groups. At one meeting, an executive recalled, Causey kept coming back to a dead deal and asking, "Was it possible the deal was still alive?" "It wasn't," responded the executive. "So there's no chance of it coming back?" "No." "Is there even a little bit of a chance of it coming back?" asked Causey. "Do you want to look at it again?" Finally, the executive took the hint, and the deal was declared undead. Enron deferred the hit for another quarter. Whatever the propriety of these maneuvers, they all had one clear effect. They rolled Enron's problems further into the future, where the issues slowly accumulated. I want to quickly tell you about something called the fraud triangle. We discussed this back in the Madoff episode, but I want to refresh your memory here. The fraud triangle is a concept that's used to predict the likelihood of fraud taking place. When three elements are all present, pressure, opportunity, and rationalization, people are more likely to commit fraud. The situation we've been talking about here is a classic example of the fraud triangle. Skilling and his cronies have immense pressure to hit their quarterly earnings targets, largely because their pay is tied to stock performance. They have a bunch of opportunities to fudge the numbers through the strategies we just talked about, accelerating deals, delaying recording losses, reinterpreting contracts, etc. And then it seems the rationalization is that they think they're just being innovative entrepreneurs to get the outcomes they're looking for. The rationalization could be a lot of things. People can rationalize anything when the outcome benefits them. But I wanted to talk through this example of the fraud triangle because it's a tool you can use when you're evaluating deals. It's really just a mental model to apply where you can ask yourself, where is the pressure here and what might the opportunities be? If you can practice getting in this mindset, you'll be much less susceptible to fraud. All right, so we've been talking about the obsession with the stock price and the ineffectiveness of the RAC and some other operational and cultural issues at Enron. I've been painting a picture of what the company was like to help us understand how and why it all fell apart. This is a great excerpt from the book that ties it together nicely. When exactly did Enron cross the line? Even now, after all the congressional hearings, all the investigative journalism, all the reports, lawsuits, and indictments, that's an impossible question to answer. There have been accounting frauds over the years where companies created receivables out of whole cloth or shipped bricks at the end of a quarter instead of products. In such cases, someone at a company has to consciously consider the fact that he or she is about to commit a crime and then commit it. But for the most part, the Enron scandal wasn't like that. The Enron scandal grew out of a steady accumulation of habits and values and actions that began years before and finally spiraled out of control. Habits and values and actions. That's a good way to put it. There wasn't a single moment when it happened, but a million little moments that added up to an enormous disaster. And that's where I'm going to leave you for today. This is part one of a two-part series on Enron. And in the next episode, we're going to learn about another central figure, Andrew Fastow. We're going to talk about the financial sandcastle Fastow and his minions built. And we're going to talk about the waves that washed that castle away. But that's next time. For now, I hope you enjoyed the episode. I hope you have a few concepts to mull over and a few insights you can apply today to your businesses and investments. And I hope you'll come back next week for part two so we can finish our conversation. Thanks for listening. We'll talk soon.